Well, I thought I knew Oliver Twist quite well, but when I read the unabridged version, I realised that I didn't know it as well as I thought I did. And I think that's the case probably with a lot of people, because the films and, of course, the musical, stage show that people have seen are obviously very much abridged, and there are subplots and there are characters that I never knew about. And so that was a nice surprise. What was a bigger surprise was that in the films and other adaptations, sometimes they even changed the facts of the book, which I found quite amazing. What I found most amazing was how Oliver is really a cipher. I mean, most of the action and a lot of the characters and a lot of the stories, they revolve around him. He's like a magnet or something in the centre, and all these stories revolve around him. He's not actually in it that often as a character, but he is the catalyst for all the events that happen, and I think I found that to be one of the most interesting facts. And when you're trying to sort of tell a story, it's not often the case that the titular character is not one of the main characters in the book, in a way. He's there, but he's not there in every scene, and if you looked at his dialogue bits, he's probably got less to say than almost any other character in the book. There are so many different characters and extreme characters in Dickens that it can either be seen as a gift for an actor or as a huge challenge. It's also, because of the previous adaptations, it's one of those stories which you have ghosts hovering in your head with performances and actors who've done them before. You can't really think about that. You've got to go back to the text. You've got to go back to what he says about their voices. And he does often describe how people speak, which is a great help. One of the things I was very keen to emphasise was that the workhouse is 70 miles from London. And in those days, 70 miles from London was a long way away. You know, it would take days to get to London. So accents would reflect that. They weren't Londoners. It's not like being in Dunstable or St Albans now. In those days, those towns would have had a country burr. They would have had an accent. More or less in a radius of, say, 30, 40 miles from London, you would have had people speaking very differently to those in London. And I wanted that to happen, because usually you get this sort of generic, oh, it's all set in London. And a lot of the characters, Noah Claypole, people like that who come to London, they're described as countrymen. Well, he's from the town where the workhouse is. He's described as a countryman. And there's lots of things that you can discover as an actor like that when you come to the full script. And I was very keen to get that. Oliver is an absolute outsider when he comes to London. It's like someone coming from another country now to London, and probably a third world country. The culture shock would have been immense, and I just wanted to sort of get some of that in the voices. The tone of the voices, again, as I said, Dickens does give you a lot of clues. I mean, Sykes, harsh, hoarse, he's very prescriptive in a way about voices. He gives you lots of clues. Fagin, I don't think you can run away from the anti-Semitism and the sort of vocal patterns that he has. You have to take it on board. When you're deciding on a voice, you have to imagine what it's like to listen to. Mr. Brownlow, who is the probably the voice that Dickens thinks of himself as in the book, he needs to be a voice that is very easy to listen to, in that you want to be with that man. You trust that man. It's completely a voice that you can trust, and one that can sort of make you feel that you'd be easy in his company. I wanted Sykes to be, from the very first word, have an earthiness and a gravitas to him that set him apart from the other villains. He goes beyond the pale by murdering Nancy. He does things that the other villains find shocking. I wanted that reflected in his voice, and that's why I chose to go really deep and give him a just an almost animal sort of quality. Because there are several old men who are RP, quite posh really, you have to differentiate them. So you can go, say with Losburn, he's incredibly keen and enthusiastic. And I think he's probably shouted quite a lot in his life about things, and he's gone a bit hoarse, but he's gone hoarse in another way, in that sort of way, which
You know, if you had him speaking to Sykes, it'd be very... You know, you can sort of... they're both hoarse, but in different ways. Grimwig, I just saw as Samuel Johnson. He's one of those Dickensian characters who are completely eccentric and has this catchphrase, "I'll eat my head." His was not so much a voice, it's a rhythm thing. So, he talks in sort of, snatches, like that, sir. And, it's a rhythm thing. That's how you differentiate. You can differentiate people with, doing different voices, different pitches, tones, or you can differentiate them with rhythm. Brownlow's rhythm is very soothing, and he's a nice old gentleman, and you trust him immediately. Grimwig you don't trust, because, you know, that's not the way he's written, and he's quite difficult to get to know, and you want to sort of reflect that in his manner of speech, because Dickens says someone is eccentric. He doesn't actually, with Grimwig, give you a voice pattern for that. So you have to think, what's an eccentric voice pattern? What can I do with that to communicate his character in a vocal and audio-friendly way? Well, my hero when I was growing up, and part of the reason that I wanted to become an actor was Richard Burton. And when I was very young, I had a record of Undermilk Wood. And I remember Burton in an interview talking about the idea of listening to oneself and imagining what it's like for a listener to listen to you. And there are certain things that I have taken on board. I hesitate to use the word tricks, but what it is things that Burton would do with words that you can use within a sentence to conjure up an image. So you can use a word like dream, you can say he had the most amazing dream, or you can say he had the most amazing dream. And in Dickens especially, I think that works very well. With some novelists, you know, it's got to be much more natural and much more verite than that. But with Dickens, he has such enthusiasm and joy of language that I think you can break up sentences, you can do things with words that conjure up the image of that word. It's almost like onomatopoeia, but you're using a word that might not necessarily be... Dream is an onomatopoeic word, but if you say it in a certain way, it makes you think that. It makes you think of a dream. It makes you feel in a dreamlike way. And there are certain things that I do when I'm reading a book or when I'm doing a radio play. I try and imagine, if I'm listening to me now, am I boring myself? Am I getting too much in the same sort of pattern of voice? What would I want to hear now? If I was listening to me, what would draw me in? And that's what I mean. It's sort of being aware of your audience as you're doing it. And that's the same for stage, telly, anything. Being aware of what the audience is receiving, because that's who you're doing it for. You're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for an audience.